these people know what they're talking about. Listen to them and stop resisting.
If I was to do anything differently, I probably wouldn't be here.
Hello and welcome to a Tale of Three Indies podcast where Cian is humming in the background again. So what have you guys been up to? Because I'm starting to feel the fear of getting ready for a festival. And
I was selling books at the military history seminar.
Getting it right or wrong.
I felt the fear.
Military history. You know, it's mad, but I'd say were the sales good?
Yeah, they were. Dermot Ferriter was the keynote speaker. But there was a local, people were interested in the local history. I just brought kind of all our local history stuff as well as the speakers' books. And yeah.
A lot of those niche events always, because the people who go to it are obviously the people who are interested. But I find they're often things that you won't necessarily sell in your shop.
Yeah. But and it was a free event. So the organisers, it was organised by Kildare Libraries. They were worried about attendance, because if you don't charge for something, you know, we've no guarantee people will turn up.
I know, and it's awful, but we have had that problem previously where you make something for free and people sign up for it and then they don't show up,
whereas just a nominal
if you
fee,
even just charge a small amount, it would be lovely to be able to offer more things for free, but it just doesn't seem.
I shuddered a little bit, Dawn, when you said it was free event. I was like, oh God, no.
The
fear, the knowledge of what that means.
But I think people wouldn't understand that. I think they think if you said that you were just saying that, I wouldn't do it for free. It's not that. It's that people don't tend to show up.
It's trying to work
especially
out
when you have to ticket. Yeah. When you have to ticket an event for the size of a room, and then
convince speakers to come and organise how many books will I bring.
I don't know why we do events.
I know why.
Because every now and again, one really pays off and it's like, this is why I do it.
No, and I know I will love the festival when I'm doing it, but it is that combination of, have I ordered too many books and then you're going to have to deal with returns and all that end of it, or have I not got enough books and then you run out and there's
nothing worse.
Both an angry author and an angry queue of people.
The fear of having
not enough books is nearly as bad.
Although
it doesn't cost you as much because you've sold
all
your
books. I feel it's worse.
Well, you've not lost.
I think I'd rather... I hate having to return them, but I think I'd still rather have...
I have an event next week with... There's six different books and they're all academic titles, which if listeners don't know, or they possibly do know, but academic titles are generally a lot more expensive. So there's a fear that when you have more than one title, more than one author, people who are coming along to the event, you know, they're coming along to support their one friend or person or the book that they're interested in, but they may not buy. Because there's six books, they feel they might have to buy all six, so they decide not to buy any. That seems to be what happens.
Yeah.
And the books next week, despite I've done my level best to get some, to be able to offer some great discounts on them, there's still four of them are over €60. So I'm like, you know, we'll see how it goes. To be continued. But then these things can surprise you and they go really well. So I don't know. It's just that fear that I have to. And it's also in Dublin, so I have to lug the books into town. And then
the other fear is always, it's not even about the books, it's the attendance. Because nobody wants to, even though we're not responsible for that side of it, unless it's an event in one of our shops. But I always hate that feeling of, it's an author that you know is popular and should have a good audience, but yet there's five people in the room.
Because the big venue is at the other end of the town, or some strange thing that you could not have in any way.
Yeah, things you don't know about. I do have my worst one that I actually can't even talk about. I still haven't recovered from it. It's too close to it. Anyway, that there was three other things going on in the town.
Things
going on in the town that I didn't know about resulted in a very poor attendance. Antonia, how did you get involved in internet?
Oh, it started way. So this is our 10th year doing it. So I got a phone call from Geraldine O'Dea, who used to own a bookshop in Navan, which has since closed down, unfortunately. And she had closed when she rang me, and she had found out that Hay Festival were talking to a committee in Kells about having. So Hay Festival is the big, huge festival that's in Wales every year. For anybody who doesn't know. But I got a warped message saying, and there's Haymaking Festival in Trim. So I got a message where I thought the Haymaking Festival was asking me that I want to set up a stall. There's nothing wrong. Yes. There is nothing wrong with the Haymaking Festival, except for the fact that I have seriously bad hay fever, and the thoughts of going to the Haymaking Festival would mean I probably wouldn't be able to see. But anyway, I eventually got an angry message where I was like, no, it's the Hay Festival from Wales. This is a big deal. So I went and met with them, and we had a chat about it. And yeah, I haven't looked back since. But yeah, they just asked me to come along and be the bookseller at the festival.
So, but now you're like...
So the first two years I was just the bookseller, and then I came onto the committee and helped a little bit with the programming, and yeah.
Fun times.
It becomes much more involved then, yeah. Becomes a lot more involved then, but yeah.
You get great
I do
names
love
as
it.
Well.
But yeah, this close you now, you then. Get. Yeah, we do. Yeah, we get some great names every year, and Miles Dungan is the curator of the festival, so he's a great man to have on your committee. A very hard worker, and he knows a lot of people as well. So we have a history day. Obviously, you'd have to have a history day if you have Miles.
Curated by Miles.
Yeah, so we have the history day on the Thursday. And that, it's like you said about when you have a niche thing, like that history day is, people will come to one event and they'll stay for the day. But that happens with the whole weekend. They come for one person that they like, and they come out, they've never been to a literary event before, and they come out and they're like, oh my god, give me a program, what else is on, I didn't realize that's what it would be like. So it's nice to see that as well.
Should have asked you this question before, because we could have actually maybe promoted and got some tickets, but I think this episode's going to go out after so
yes,
next year.
So if you missed it, it's always the last weekend of June. So if you missed the 2022 festival, start looking out. There's Facebook, Instagram, the whole lot, Twitter. You'll find it, and the hinterland.ie page. So they'll be delighted with me now that I promoted it for 2023.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, with that, we should move on to today's interview. And today we're joined by author and journalist Seamus O'Reilly. Seamus's book, Did You Hear Mammy Died, is out now in paperback. It is available in all good bookshops, but especially ours, antoniasbookstore.com, themaynoothbookshop.com, and woodbinebooks.ie, or obviously in any of our physical shops as well. So here's the interview that we recorded earlier. Welcome to the podcast, Seamus, and thank you so much for joining us today on A Tale of Three Indies podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's good to be back. We were just, before we started recording there, we were all singing a little bit. Cian likes to sing in the background.
Well, we don't have elevator music, so I kind of have to do have the entertainment. We don't have an elevator. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, good point, well made. My daughter has learned that trick. She's four,
pressing the button.
And she's learned that thing, pressing the button behind and disappearing down behind the couch. I don't know where she got it from, but it's now
Bluey.
Part of her repertoire.
It's Bluey.
Is it Bluey?
It's Bluey.
My thing.
And she's only started watching Bluey. There you go.
Yeah,
Bluey is the best TV program.
Definitely,
it's brilliant.
It's genuinely really that 1 hour block between with Dougie into two episodes of Dougie and two episodes of Bluey is absolutely game changing. It's like HBO in the late 90s. It's like Laurie Sanders double bill. It's like, oh my god, this is so incredible.
I might sit down and watch Bluey with you. Yeah, no, the one thing you want to watch on children's TV.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, I'm waiting for her to get into SpongeBob as well. Sorry, we'll stop talking.
Anyway, that's
children's
not anything
television.
About books. Yeah.
No, we can talk children's television if you want. But I think we're here today to talk about your memoir, Did You Hear Mommy Died, which was out last year in trade paperback and is just out now in paperback. And it tells the story of the death of your mother when you were 5 and your childhood with your father and 10 siblings in the aftermath of the tragedy. Why did you decide to write the book? Like, where did that come from, that you sat down and decided to put pen to paper?
It's a good question. As a writer professionally, and always having these stories in the sort of the locker, it kind of made sense. And also the fact that I'm I've told a lot of the stories that form the spine of the book for years and years, and only in the telling, especially as I've moved first to Dublin and then to London, seeing how weird they were to other people. So growing up, I didn't think it was normal to have 10 brothers and sisters. That was very clearly not normal, contrary to the expectations of English people. Particularly, we don't all have 10 brothers and sisters, but I there were loads of things that I did completely took for granted, like you know, just the sheer amount of comings and goings that having 10 brothers and sisters involved, like telling people, for example, you know, what it was like to get up in the morning, and you know, how did you all have breakfast, how did anyone use a bathroom, all that stuff. I had to think about it again when I was writing the book and say, well, there's actually loads of stuff here. So the short answer is that I was asked to write a book because someone had seen some stuff I'd done about my dad on Twitter and a few short pieces I'd written. And they just had no idea that there was so much. So I was able to reply and say, there's actually loads of very strange things about this childhood, but also hopefully sort of not sort of disturbingly strange, hopefully funny strange. And so that just involved going through all of my old memories, literally writing a spreadsheet of memories, which is very artistic. I'm sure Kafka did the same thing, and just trying to whittle down and say which of these are, you know, just a funny story and which of them are actually kind of point to something larger. So the whole book is effectively kind of almost like a series of essays, really, more than a chronological, you know, the year was 1995 and I still wasn't over my mother's death or whatever. It's more thematic, I suppose, than that. So having those memories as the base plate, it kind of made that whole process a lot easier, and I think worked to make it, you know, a better read than maybe just me listing all of the traumas and tragedies of my life might have been, because I also wanted it to be a funny book and to have that energy of someone telling you a story round a table with a glass of wine, you know, which is, it's built to entertain and also to kind of get into the deeper stuff maybe than the sort of glib back of the book version of the story.
Yeah, because if you read the title, you know, it could sound like it's going to be a very sad and depressing book, but it really isn't. I mean, it is sad, obviously, but there's a lot of funny moments in it, and you do have 10 siblings to tell stories.
I'm sure there's loads left out. That was the other side of it.
I'd say there's tons. And how did you decide what to leave in and what to take out, or were you told by anybody to take certain things back out?
Well, I did have... I mean, if you mean my brothers and sisters and stuff, kept me on a very long leash. I've been writing about my family for 4 years with a column in The Observer, mostly about my literal immediate family, my wife and my son, and now my daughter who's just been born. Because the column is about parenting and family and being Irish in London and all those things. And what I've discovered is that if I go too long without mentioning some members of my family, they get annoyed. It's never the opposite. No one is ever annoyed. And I think it's one of the benefits of telling stories in which I'm clearly making myself out to be a buffoon a lot of the time, and tragic, you know, and inept and absurd, because I am all of those things and everyone is all of those things. I discovered it gave me a great license to do the same of other people, because, you know, if I'm talking about all of the delusions and sort of naivety and arrogance that was inherent in my childhood, and I think most people's childhoods, if I foreground things with that, then it means that I can slag off my dad for having the worst taste in music that's ever existed, or that he's so cosmically square that he had to be explained what a high five was. You know, that's I get the license for that. And to some extent, my dad's actually... He likes being talked about, even if it's not particularly positive, because, you know, he knows that it's a joke, and it follows the same rules as it does around the kitchen table, where if you can make someone laugh, you get the free hit. There was nothing in the book, I don't think, at any stage, which I mean, I'm not, you know, Carl Ove Nysgaard. I'm not someone who's like, oh, you know, screw my family, I don't care, you know, the warts and all. I don't want to hurt anybody, so I'm sure I left out stuff that was embarrassing or horrible and stuff. But in terms of the things that I kept in, it was all based on balancing stuff that I found funny and stuff that wasn't letting me off the hook. And some of the stuff that wasn't letting me off the hook might have been, you know, making myself look stupid or funny. But more and more as I started writing it, it was things which delved into, you know, deeper stuff. You know, how sad I was, how angry I was, how grief was, you know, working its way through me. And to some extent, the sort of jokey title and a lot of the funny stories in the book, slowly as you read the book, and particularly as you get into the last couple of chapters, I'd hope, it becomes clear that an awful lot of this humour is a coping mechanism. And it's expressly that, and I think should be that, and I think it's a useful coping mechanism. I'm kind of in favour of it. But that also means there's loads of parts of my experience of grief, my experience of family, my experience of my relationships, even now to this day, where I run away from serious things and make jokes about them, and have become very good at that. So writing the book, getting that across on the page, not only doing that, but acknowledging that that's what I was doing, that became the big challenge, but easily the most gratifying thing when I felt like I did that right. So the other thing that I left out was loads of jokes, because as I started doing that, I realized you can't just get away with joking and joking and joking to get yourself out of a sad bit. You can't do it in life, and you can't do it on the page, because you and your readers will rightfully feel ripped off, because you're just getting so close to something and then you're telling another, you know, one-liner. So I had to sacrifice a lot of really good jokes, which is annoying.
I hope you just filed them away, though.
I think has any right. I did that same thing Marianne Keyes talks about, where I have a little folder, but I'll never look at it again, because it's just one of those things. But I do, I have that hoarder's instinct where I keep them all. But as I was writing the book, and I'd realize, you're rereading it, I'd say, you're just letting yourself off the hook here. You've just about mentioned how sad you were, or how angry you were, or how you lashed out at someone, or how you blamed yourself, and then you immediately start telling a joke again. So I fought that instinct as much as possible, particularly in the editing process. And so a large part of that self-censorship was digging into the deeper stuff at the expense of gags, so that the ones that remained did their work.
Well, I have to say, you've pretty much answered my next question. But what I will say is that I generally avoid books like yours that are, you know, about personal tragedy. They're not my cup of tea. Well, I don't even know if they're my cup of tea. But I really enjoyed your book, and I thought you got that balance really. You struck it really well, and it's just listening to you say that you know, you had to pull back a little bit. I think that's probably what made it so engaging.
Yeah, and I think as well, a lot of Irish humour is just that in a nutshell. I mean, it's a hoary old cliche that everyone has heard a million times, that, you know, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. You know, the gallows humour, the fact that in a wake, you'll always have those pockets of people laughing. But some cliches are cliches because they're true. And even though I wrote about that in the first chapter, the second chapter, I'd get to write in the sixth chapter and be like, I'm doing the thing that I was saying was, you know, was so ingrained in people and, you know, commenting on this thing, but I was doing the same thing. And coming back to what I just kind of glanced towards earlier, I'm not against it. I think it really helped me get through my grief, and I think everyone's even had, when it doesn't have to be childhood bereavement, I think everyone has been dumped or been sacked in the job, and they've gone out with the friends that make them laugh the most. And you know, it shouldn't make you feel much better. I mean, the same thing happened 4 hours ago as it does now. But being able to laugh, that reflex, and being able to get through things faster. I think to some extent, laughter isn't just a way of dealing with grief, which if that was all it was, it would be useful. I think it almost accelerates the process. It doesn't distract. It builds its own bridge to get you to a better place faster. So I like to stick up for that, especially since I might be kind of similar to you, Cian, in that I'd read a lot of these books or watch very, very worthy, beautiful movies, which I've been doing a lot. I'm doing a lot of sort of night care for our baby between about 10 and 3 a.m. So I'm just watching loads of movies I've just never got around to seeing, and a lot of them are these long, sad movies, and I'm like, is no one cracking a joke?
Like, give me something.
Lighten up. Does this, where is the, and I don't even mean because it's against my sensibilities, which it might be, but because it might as well be set on Mars. Where is this place where everyone is sad all the time? You know, in the worst possible experiences. You know, the funniest people I knew growing up were present at bombings and at massacres, you know? I mean, that sounds flippant, but it's, these were not people who kind of, their every single day was an art house movie shot in black and white where, you know, it was just Sturm and Drang. Even the people going through the worst thing in the world, if they're not themselves cracking jokes, there will be someone they meet over the course of 2 hours documented in a film. So it always jumps me out when I see those kind of very miserable things, because it seems almost like that's cheating to me. Because why would you not capture that? Why would you not capture the weird uncle at the wake who says the wrong thing? You know, that's not cheap. That's real. You know, pretending that everyone was posing and beautifully shot and sad in this very cinematic way, that to me is cheaper, because you're not capturing the real thing. You're sketching over a different hard part, just as surely as an Adam Sandler movie, you know, doesn't have the gravitas of the unbearable lightness of being. The reverse is true. People laugh in real life at all times. So it behooved me to lean into that, because that's what I wanted to write. It's what I want to read.
I know people have said this before about you, but your writing really reminds me of David Sedaris. You've got the large family, the closeness of the family relationships, and the laugh out loud stories. Given that you have 5 more siblings than he does, and your father is much more likeable and just as funny as his, will there be more stories about the O'Reilly family?
A, yes. B, I adore David Sedaris. I think it's quite
he's brilliant.
Obvious. And I sometimes do wish that I did have a father as heinous as he has. I mean, I always feel that way, but loads of those great writers of that type, the sort of humorous with a capital H that I think Americans do well. Which is, how do you have all these experiences? I mean, I've just been done for, I don't know if you know that Twitter account, the Didn't Happen of the Year Award. It's basically someone sees something that seems unlikely. So a classic example would be, I went into the polling booth and I said, no way am I going to vote for Boris Johnson. And everyone clapped and cheered, you know, that kind of fake story. And I got done with one about 2 weeks ago and I was livid. I was really livid because I was just, why are you not believing me? Why are you not believing that this really happened? But it does make me think that about David Sedaris sometimes when I read his stories, because I do wish that my family were as endlessly memorable. And I sometimes wonder if he provokes them into extreme situations, because I do that sometimes for my colleagues.
He is old, a good bit older than you, so you have a few years to do it. But he writes down everything, doesn't he, in a notebook, and then hones it until it's...
Yeah, I wish I had that discipline. Or rather, I wish I'd had that discipline when I was younger so I could read it now. I know everyone says that. Yeah, exactly. I mean, geez, I can't imagine if I went back and looked at the sort of things that I was saying and thinking. But I'd love it, but I'd probably hate it. They wouldn't have survived by now. But at 15, I would have burned the 8-year-old diaries. And at 25, I would have burned the 18. Because I just, that kind of... being under a microscope, I think I would find
with that many
hard.
Brothers and sisters, you can't keep a diary anyway, can you? It's just ammunition.
No.
No.
Can you imagine? No, and not only that, but I already have a complete, perfect record of everything I ever said or did, because I have 10 external hard drives just waiting to
remind you.
Yeah, and I do like to say that it's a bit like, I think people hear that I've got 10 brothers and sisters because I tell people so often, but they hear that and. They say a thing which is kind of true, which is, oh my God, you must have such a great record. And that is absolutely true. So writing the book, I set up a WhatsApp group and we had so much ammunition and so much incredible stories from things that I couldn't remember. The book starts when I'm 5. So obviously my memories are very flaky, you know, where they are even exist at all. So I was able to get a much more 3D rendered picture. But in saying that, that might give you the idea that it's like a Bourne movie where I've got like 10 people like on satellite images and all together we can find where the terrorist camp is or something. It's more often, it's a bit like having 10 cats and trying to get them into the oven. because they all disagree on everything, even the most specific, presumably memorable things. Half the people weren't there, or half of them don't remember it. Some of them remember it, but they remember it exactly, diametrically opposite to another person who's equally vociferous about the fact that it happened this way. So, I mean, a simple, quite mundane example. I mean, it's quite a profound example, but it's mundane just in the sense that I can't understand why they don't remember it. Was when my dad rang home from Belfast in the hospital to tell us that Mummy had died and that he was coming home. Half of my family remember my brother Dara answering the phone. Half remember my sister Sinead. Neither of them know. No one knows. It's the sort of thing you would imagine you would remember if you picked up the phone and you had that call, but you don't. Whereas I remember my first taste of a banana sandwich, but I don't remember being told that my mum died. You know, it's the flakiness of memory is something that I go into in the book as well, because I started off with 5 memories. And by the time I'd finished it, I had 8. So if no one had ever read the book, and if Tommy Bo hadn't made me a viral meme, and if all of this was just a nice little pamphlet that I made, and, you know, 20 years from now, people say, oh, I heard you wrote a book once, then it would still have been worth it, because I got 60% extra memories of my mum over the course of writing it. So...
yeah, and there was parts of the book when I was reading it, because my mom comes from a family of 6 and my dad comes from a family of 7. So it's some of your stories actually made me pick up the phone a few times going, oh, mom, there's this bit where, and it's reminded me of, because things like one of her aunts who lived in England used to come home and go, how do you all know who each other is? And, you know, and there was only 6 of them. I was like, well, how do you know if who's Colette and who's Loretto? I was like,
because humans,
my siblings. That's how you know. But yeah, there was lots of bits like that. And I love the part, and 6 of them used to squash into a car. At least you had the bus. I loved that bit with your dad driving the bus and realising that he thought he had left 1 child behind at the church.
Only to discover
it may have been more than 1.
That's a perfect example as well of a story which I had not heard until... I mean, you imagine how often we tell these stories, how many drunken nights we've just, you know, assassinated each other with silly stories. And that I only heard while I was writing the book, because you just keep going over things and asking different questions, and you get loads of different satellite pictures from the sort of CIA network of sort of snoopers that are my family and their internal records of events. But like, it is weird because a lot of people have said that thing to me, like, how did y'all keep everyone, you know, keep the numbers right or know everybody's names? And then I would say, well, it's, you know, you do just remember, because it's a big family, but it's not that big.
It's like, it's, you know, like people have never met more than 5 people in their lives that they remember the names of. You know?
remembered all the names of the people
but
in your class. Like,
having,
you know,
said that, my editor, that is to say my legal copy editor for the book, a lovely woman named Zoe, she got me with a passage where she said, hey, I think you mean there's 8 more kids, not 7. And I went back and I looked and said, yep, I have miscounted how many brothers and sisters I have. You've caught me on paper doing this. I spelt my own name wrong a few times in the book. I left off the fada several times. I spelt the name of the book wrong. So it's Did Ye Hear Mummy Died? And I knew this, but I put Did You Hear Mummy Died just in speed, just wrote too quick. And it was there until like the 8th draft. And I kicked off and I was like, geez, these English editors, they know nothing of the Hibernian lilt. And then I went back and it's there from the very earliest version.
It's so, all you.
So nothing is reliable.
Well, just that that bus moment with your dad, I loved. But your father really comes across throughout the book as a wonderful man. And your love for him really shines through in it. Was it difficult to put this into words and to get it into the book? Because it just comes straight off the page.
Well, that's nice to hear. My dad will be delighted. He's getting a very big head, by the way.
We should have got him on the podcast.
You say that, but I went to do a signing in Donegal in October. It was actually on the 30th anniversary of my mother's passing, so it was in October, just there gone. And it was the first time he was able to come, and only time he came to one of my events, because I came home to Derry and we all drove together to Donegal. And I mentioned this, and we had a lovely chat. It was sort of one of those things where you're on stage and you're being interviewed about the book and you do a few readings and then there's questions from the audience and stuff. Typical thing. And throughout the course of it, I said, well, my father is actually here, and people clapped and everything. I was like, okay, it was a much bigger turnout than I expected. My dad was astonished because I don't think he thinks...
he thought he was making up the numbers.
Anybody should... Like, absolutely, yeah. He's in that sense, he is a bit like David Sedaris' dad, who famously tells him all the empty seats in one of the books. Oh, I saw at least 40 empty seats in the back there. So if David Sedaris gets that, then I should get a, you know, triple or quadruple. So I mentioned this, and so people kind of were like, oh, daddy is here. And so at the end, I set myself up at my little table, and there was a nice, healthy crowd of people waiting to get their book signed by the genius author, Seamus O'Reilly. And all the books arrived and they were already signed. And signed by a signature I know extremely well because I used to forge it for all of my matters relating to school, because my dad could not be arsed signing for like 20,000 children and all of their different school trips. And so I was like, looked up, and my dad, there was a secondary line just as long as mine of people going up to shake his hand and get signed. So he's never invited to another one again, obviously. Security has increased. But yes, it was really, really nice to talk about him. And I think because someone said something in a few of these sort of events and things where I've talked about the book, and they made a point that I hadn't even thought about, which is you very rarely see a very positive, affectionate portrayal of a dad in a memoir of this type. And I was sure that it was just, you know, kind of one person's opinion until I started realizing. And then I realized I've never really read one either. Like, and my dad is very crotchety and stuck in his ways and ridiculous in so many ways, you know, that aren't necessarily all positive. You know, he can be very crabbit and unreasonable. He's a giant child about certain things, but like all people are. But I wanted to get across just how much I love him, because I do. And because I think it was the only way I thought that it would make sense to tell this story, is to talk about the person who is pretty much the protagonist. You know, the book is basically pretending that I'm the protagonist because I'm so self-absorbed. But A, there's 11 of me, and then there's the guy who's actually looking after them. And I think especially as I've gotten older, most especially since I've become a dad myself, but even in my teens and 20s, when I started to realize how, as much as I thought, because we suffered grief and because we were a very huggy, loving family compared to a lot of my friends' families, I think it's fair to say, you know, we didn't take him for granted. You know, we understood we'd lost a mom, and so we loved our dad, you know, and all that. And that is true. But we didn't have a clue. You know, we really didn't. And it's only as we got older and we started to just think, how did you do that? You're 44, you've been widowed, the love of your life. He's never remarried or anything, or had any other relationship. And you just stuck your head down and you brought up 11 kids who are mostly normal. But even just, it was like, I was in my 20s before I thought, how did he pay for any of this? He was on a single civil servant's wage. He had no free time. He was taking us to choir practice. He was taking us to band and to sports and all this kind of stuff. So a lot of the reason why I kind of layered so heavily on him is because he's inarguably the best character in the book, because he's the best character in my experience of life in that time. And it's kind of sort of score settling, because maybe I didn't, as much as I thought I appreciated him, every year it becomes more. I mean, I've said this many times, but since I've become a parent, you know, literally every single day that my children are still alive, I feel like there should be street parties in my honor. There should be a medal ceremony. There should be like a garland, you know, like from a luau, like placed around my neck, and I should be waving at huge cheering crowds. And so the idea that my dad was doing this with 11 kids, the youngest of whom was 2 and the oldest was 17. So, I mean, there's an argument that either end of that spectrum is a complete nightmare. You know, having a 17-year-old is not easy. Having a 2-year-old is impossible. And he had a 2-year-old, a 17-year-old, and 9 children in between. So there was no choice really other than to talk about him and the stuff he did, and at least avoid too much clawing sentimentality by mercilessly ripping the piss into him for all the things about him that are ridiculous, and I had to leaven that bread. I did not want this to be too sickly sweet, which it could have been. And so that's where an awful lot of the avenues for jokes were sort of available.
But I think the stories where you laugh at him make him seem really real, like all his videotapes and his indexing of all the films that were on them, and his correcting you about the measurements of the, you got the measurement of the car wrong, or you got the year of this wrong. It just make him seem like a real person that you know. Yeah. You really feel like you know him.
I listened to most of the book on audiobook. I had to drive up and down to Wexford in a day, so you were my company for most of the at 1.2 speed. So it's actually nice to hear you at regular speed here today. But anyway, that's an aside. Was it hard to keep your composure when you were reading that? Because I welled up on numerous occasions listening to you tell your stories, and
even
particularly you've already mentioned it, like where the fact that you only had five memories, and then that even that got me kind of going. So I'm driving down the N11. And I'm starting to well up with that, and then you mentioned that you've had three more since writing it, and I was like, oh god, like, was it a hard thing to do to sit down and narrate it?
Well, firstly, thank you for letting me accompany you on a road trip. That was lovely. And the audiobook, the fact that so many people have mentioned the audiobook is really nice, because I really wanted to do it, because so much of the tone and the inflection of the story and the book is hyper specific. If it's not delivered in a slight deadpan or with a knowing sort of affect, it could come off as overly miserable or overly silly. So I think a lot of that was a performance. Also, in terms of actually finding it hard, there's a bit at the end of the second chapter which I find very hard to read even still, and I actually cried when I was writing it. I must have looked like a complete psychopath sitting at my computer, kind of crying. I think I remember my wife was out of the house with our son, so I had the house complete to myself, which is extremely rare. And I just remember being like, I've been putting off writing about this thing, and you know, it's a bit where I'm talking about a dream that I was constantly having after my mum died, and wanting to be held by someone whose heart is not breaking. And I find it so moving in a way that's like, I am such a unbelievably sensitive man. Look at me writing my feelings. But it was more just, when you write something, I'm sure anyone listening who's ever written anything personal will know, you can absolutely read something and know something for the first time as you're writing it. In fact, you can read it back and see something that you didn't know you'd written, if you know what I mean. So in that process, absolutely. By the time I was reading the audiobook, I developed a cold, hard callus over my heart. I think I still did find some parts of it tougher than others in an absolute truth. But generally, it was about trying to get that inflection right. And reading the audiobook was also important to me, because I actually read the entire book into this very microphone twice while I was writing it. So if I'm loath to give unsolicited writing advice, like, any time. But this is not about ideas, this is not about skills, this is just pure, cold, hard practicality. Anybody on earth can do this, and it requires no skill, no writing talent at all. Get a mic and read it out loud, if you can. David Sedaris, of whom, of course, talking, he says, talk in front of an audience. I've done that once or twice, and I don't, sometimes you get too much feedback either way. I don't like it. I kind of like just the fact of saying something out loud. You hear false steps, you hear crunchy lines, you hear prose that is just too many little curlicues, and too you're being too clever by half. You catch all those immediately when you say it out loud. You're tripping over, you're biting your tongue because you're trying to force too many words in, or I am anyway. That's my big sin as a writer. And so I get rid of those, and then I stop the recording, delete it, whatever, and then I start again with the new text. So by the end of 3-4 days it took me to read an early draft, and it was in shape, you know, I liked it, and I put it on my phone. I even went so far as to like give all the images, like all the audio files, like little images, like the front cover of a book, so it felt like an audiobook. Weirdly, this worked in my brain. Clearly I was also procrastinating from doing any more serious work on the book, but it worked. So I left that and literally did not touch it. It was on my phone for 3 weeks, and then I just would go out running or go for a walk, do the dishes, and have it playing like a normal audiobook, listening to it almost, you know, as a for, with that distance. And I heard loads more stuff. I was like, that's false. That feels like you're repeating yourself. Why are you talking about this now? That's insincere. And also you get used to the sound of your own voice, which is always good, a good exercise. And so I'd go back and I'd prune it further and further. And then, you know, there's more edits and different things changed, chapters taken out, things put back in. So then a year after that, I did the whole process again and changed it even more than I had the first time. Because when you're staring at something on the page, you just see this massive wall of text and you see all of the versions of it that were there before. And you think that you've brought something up, you think you've set up a joke, but you haven't paid it off, or vice versa. You think you haven't already mentioned this story, or you think that you have mentioned this person. So when it comes up later on, you don't realize that your readers are going to be like, who's this person? I don't understand. Why is that funny? Even the most silly, stupid things like that, you know, really kind of add up. So by the time I came to do the audiobook, I was very, very familiar with all the words, even those ones that made me cry. One thing that did surprise me was there's loads of poncy French words in the book. It's probably about a dozen.
So like, I was just going to say, of French yes. words in books.
Pronouncing stuff but is like, not my forte.
But like, oh, nor mine. My recording engineer was French. And she was like, why do you keep using these? No one says bon vivre. No one. What are you talking about? And I was like, I don't remember writing this many things, but clearly I just reach for an old timey sounding thing quite a lot. So it's often very Victorian heightened English because I think it makes me sound stupid and sort of self-absorbed. And then occasionally French, a little French word, because it's like a little curlicue. It's like a little pat myself on the back for having a vocabulary. But it was mortifying to do this in front of a French person who was completely baffled as to why I'd chosen these words.
We have only time for one more question, so it's a really important one. You won Biography of the Year for Did You Hear Mammy Died at the Amposta Irish Book Awards. Where do you keep your award?
I keep it here in my in-laws' house, but shortly I will be bringing it home as the conquering hero because it's really heavy. It's really heavy, so I don't know. I haven't actually seen it up. I like the idea that they've been taking it around the town themselves. But yes, it... it has been, I think, in a cupboard here. So I'm going to bring it home and put it somewhere incredibly
build
obnoxious.
A special extension for it, maybe.
Yeah, with like underlit sort of things. Just stand by it.
Water feature.
That's what we need. Yeah, and like one of those little cats with the
that waves.
Going. but it's holding the award to kind of like thrust it into people's faces. It's very nice. It's kind of. I think I can probably say this. Yeah, they made me take a picture of me holding the full award as well, just in case I won it, because I don't think they wanted to like get me over again. Just take that picture. So I did get to hold the actual big award at one point, but
the book of the year one.
I know, but I good old Fintan, he snatched it from me. I know.
We won't say anything bad in case we try to get him on.
Yeah, thank you so much, Seamus, for joining us. If anybody wants to get in touch with us, you can email us on atale of3indies@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @3indies and on Facebook, we're atale of3indies. So there's lots of ways to get in touch and follow us. And if you like our podcast, please share with your friends.